Hello and welcome to Mail Call, a podcast of news, letters, and stories from the Great War. We are bringing you the news as it happened 100 years ago, from the eyes, ears, and presses of those who lived through the First World War. In this episode, we'll be covering the Second Russian Revolution of 1917, which occurred in October 100 years ago. We'll be starting in July 1917 with this article from the Washington Herald, a piece on international relations and Africa, published on July 30th, 1917.
Africans hate Teuton sway, British administrator says, by John L. Balderston. In the discussion of peace terms in England, the problem of Germany's colonies in Africa looms larger and larger. It is realized that their acquirement by Great Britain would be misunderstood and might be disapproved of by Russians and Americans, to whom the no-annexation policy appeals. On the other hand, to turn the conquered territories back to their former masters appears impossible to those who have had experience of what German rule in Africa means to the native. Sir Harry Johnston, former British High Commissioner in Nigeria, and regarded as the greatest living authority in the empire on African questions, answered the question, should the British, French, and Belgian evacuate what was formerly German Africa and readmit Germany as a ruling power into the African continent, as follows. To this I say no, no matter how long America and Western Europe have to fight to secure peace on the other terms. And I say no with the greater vehemence in that I am convinced from the correspondence that has passed between educated spokesmen of the native races and myself, that I am voicing the feelings, the deep-seated feelings, of something like 15 millions of Africans who have had every reason to loathe German rule. But in abstracting all Africa from coming again under the German flag, I would not go to the opposite extreme, after peace is made, of shutting out German commerce from what has hitherto been German Africa, or for that matter, German Asia, or Oceania. I think some arrangement should be made by which, and what were her former colonial possessions, Germany should be allowed to trade on the same footing as all other nations. Do I agree with the internationalization of Central Africa? Emphatically not. I believe in the eventual creation, under the protection of European flags, of a number of self-dependent and independent Negro nationalities, ruling themselves on civilized principle. I believe in nationality as I believe in the great virtue of individuality. Sir Harry Johnston proceeded to give reasons why, in his judgment, Germany has forfeited her right to her colonies. First of all, he said, we must remember that German ministers still in office have stated, indirectly it may be, but yet plainly, to those who understand, that when they are back again in control of tropical Africa, they intend to weld it into a huge slave state in which the millions of black men shall simply be trained as well-cared-for helots of the white men, drilled to form unconquerable armies, untiring workers, destined to make Germany mistress of the resources of the Dark Continent. Is it fair to give back German Africa to Germany when the millions of its native inhabitants are vehemently opposed to such a course, have said in no uncertain voice that they never voluntarily or knowingly gave their countries to Germany? There were only some 10,000 German colonists, exclusive of a few thousand German soldiers, in the whole of German Africa when war broke out. Very few indeed were the more or less fake treaties on which Germany based her occupation. Africans have not been well or fairly treated by Germany since she entered in possession, and they would far sooner see their territories placed and their nationhood grow up under other flags if they are to have the white man as master of all.
Up next, we have a fundraising booklet raising money to aid the Russian army by providing a crucial service. Please consider retroactively supporting the American Ambulance in Russia.
The American Ambulance in Russia, affiliated with the Russian Red Cross and approved by the new government. Help us! Today, far away on the desolate Galician front just behind the firing line, the motor ambulances of the American ambulance are saving the lives of brave Russian soldiers and showing them that in this, their hour of need, America has not completely forgotten. We need more ambulances. We need gauze, bandages, chloroform, all in large quantities. Constant appeals are coming from our men in the field. Will you not help us? Dr. Philip Newton, who has been sent by the committee to Russia and is surgeon of the ambulance unit now working there, has just returned from the Russian front to try to get more motor ambulances which are urgently needed. He reports as follows. The American Ambulance in Russia is the only organization working with the Russian Army. It consists of 50 ambulances and a field hospital and is doing active service in the Carpathian Mountains, 20 miles southwest of Kolomea on the Galician front. It is known throughout the Army as a gift from the American people, and I have been requested to convey the thanks of the Russian Army to the American people for their kindness in sending this much-needed help. Materialize your expression of thanks for your health and happiness by contributing to the fund now being raised for a new ambulance unit and the establishment of an American ambulance hospital. We take gladly one penny or a million pennies. Every one will go directly to Russia with no deduction and will reach them in their hour of suffering.
And now we jump ahead to October 1917 and bring you this article from the Harrisburg Telegraph, published just a few days before the Bolshevik Revolution began. From the director of the Russian Information Bureau, The Danger of Russia.
Bolsheviki, The Danger of Russia. The present political situation in Russia can be presented in a few words. The country is passing through a crisis which is without doubt the gravest crisis in all Russian history. Not a single party, but only a strong coalition of all the progressive forces can save the country. Russia as a whole perfectly understands the situation and demands a coalition cabinet. Responding to this demand, Kerensky formed the coalition cabinet. But the crisis is not yet over. The Bolsheviki are against the principle of coalition and demand that all power be turned over to the councils of working men's and soldiers' delegates. It is not very probable that they will finally yield to Kerensky's decision, and therefore we may expect a conflict between them and the provisional government at almost any moment. The history of the Bolsheviki in Russia after the revolution is a history of their steady growth. When Lenin appeared in Russia, immediately after the revolution, it seemed that he, with his extravagant views, had hardly any following in the country. The situation has changed since then. The Bolsheviki now control the Petrograd and Moscow councils of working men's and soldiers' delegates. They control the councils in some of the provincial cities, and they have a very considerable number of seats in the Democratic Conference. If the Bolsheviki are permitted to exist in the present-day Russia as a legitimate, openly acting political power, we will see their strength growing and growing. This is the greatest danger which revolutionary Russia faces at the present time. The rule of the Bolsheviki in Russia, if the moment for such rule comes, will be almost a death sentence for our country and the revolution. The growth of the Bolsheviki power can be very well explained. The term Bolsheviki was used for the first time in 1903, when the Russian Social Democratic Party split into two, and the majority, led by Lenin, accepted this name. Bolsheviki in Russian means the majority. Until the present war, the Bolsheviki, including Lenin, really represented a part of the Russian Social Democratic Party, and could be recognized as socialists of the Marxian school, differing from other Russian Social Democrats only on questions of tactics. The war has changed Lenin and his following. When Lenin arrived in Petrograd and made his first speech, one of the prominent Russian socialists told him that the point of view he, Lenin, represents has nothing to do with socialism and is a pure expression of anarchistic ideology. This really describes Bolshevism and explains its power in Russia. The Bolsheviki are anarchists, if not in theory, then in their feeling about life and in their political practice. The ground for anarchy is fertile in Russia, and herein lies the success of the Bolsheviki. The sufferings of all the countries involved in the present conflict are enormous. But probably it is safe to say that aside from Belgium, no country has suffered so much as Russia. To the usual sufferings imposed by the war were added the terrible crimes of the old regime. If monarchy in Russia had died 12 years ago during the first revolution, it would have been a natural death, and both sides would have gained by it. The principle of monarchy and the Tsar himself would not have been so hated as now. And on the other hand, the country would not have been poisoned as it is now. The monarchic system in its practically unlimited form was dead in Russia long ago, and decaying poisoned all the atmosphere around it. The old regime degenerated to such figures as Sukhomlinov, Rasputin, and Protopopov, came to an end, leaving the country in a state of such disorganization that no government in the world could have led it through the enormous difficulties better than the provisional government did. The disorganization of transportation brought hunger and cold to the Russian cities and created an atmosphere in which every kind of anarchistic agitation could be successful. Lenin and his followers, with their slogan of immediate peace, with their hatred for the wealthy classes, with their plans for dictatorship of the laboring class, naturally could appeal more to the suffering, comparatively uneducated Russian masses than the arguments of socialist leaders like Kerensky and Tseretelli, who appealed to the masses to stay in the war, and if necessary, suffer more and more for the cause of the world's democracy. As I have said once before, Kerensky is no less a socialist than Lenin, but the difference between them is that while Lenin would like to establish the socialist state almost immediately, Kerensky understands that an apple, sweet and ready to be eaten in October, is sour and indigestible in June. The Bolsheviki are the kind of revolutionists who discredit the revolution more than any direct enemy of socialism. The rule of the Bolsheviki in the near future is almost inevitable, if they be not eliminated from Russian life by immediate, decisive measures. Otherwise, their power is liable to grow, and will grow with the coming winter, with the hunger and cold threatening almost every Russian home. The Bolsheviki danger is like a cancer. If it is not operated on in time, it is bound to grow till it reaches the vital organs and kills the patient. The situation in Russia is critical and dangerous, and the determination of Kerensky will have against him the Bolsheviki, but with him will be entire Russia, at least 95% of the revolutionary democracy, still unaffected by the terrible disease, anarchy. A physical clash between the Bolsheviki and the forces supporting the provisional government is almost inevitable, and under the current circumstances it need not create fear. There are very few chances that the Bolsheviki will suddenly understand the seriousness of the situation and sincerely yield to the provisional government. Most probably they will not do so, and therefore the sooner the inevitable clash comes, the better for Russia, for Russian democracy, and for the great cause of the world's democracy.
Our selection of news and stories brings us to coverage of the revolution in the United States. While it is October in Russia, it is November here in the US. So while the dates have jumped, the news is in real time. We now have two articles back to back from the New York Herald covering the events in Russia, published on November 8th and 13th, 1917.
Red Revolt again menaced to Petrograd. Revolution again threatens Russian capital. Maximalists send naval forces to Russian capital and seize Telegraph, occupy preliminary parliament building. Woman's battalion before Winter Palace protect Kerensky, who refuses to outlaw Bolsheviki. Petrograd Wednesday. An armed naval detachment under the order of the Maximalist Revolutionary Committee has occupied the offices of the official Petrograd Telegraph Agency. The Maximalists also occupied the Central Telegraph Office, the State Bank, and Marie Palace, where the preliminary parliament has suspended its proceedings in view of the situation. No disorders are yet reported, with the exception of some outrage by Apaches. The general life of the city remains normal, and street traffic has not been interrupted. In the early hours of the morning, a delegation of Cossacks appeared at the Winter Palace and told Premier Kerensky that they were disposed to carry out the government's orders concerning the guarding of the capital. but they insisted that if hostilities commenced, it would be necessary for their forces to be supplemented by infantry units. They further demanded that the premier define the government's attitude towards the Bolsheviki, citing the release from custody of some of those who had been arrested for participation in the July disturbances. The Cossacks virtually made a demand that the government proclaim the Bolsheviki as outlaws. The premier replied, "I find it difficult to declare the Bolsheviki as outlaws. The attitude of the government towards the present Bolsheviki activities is known." The premier explained that those who had been released were on bail and that any of them found participating in new offenses against peace would be severely dealt with. Numerous precautions have been taken by Premier Kerensky to thwart the threatened outbreak of the Bolsheviki. The soldiers guarding the government building have been replaced by men from the officers' training schools. The women's battalion is drawn up in the square in front of the Winter Palace. Leon Trotsky, president of the Central Executive Committee of the Petrograd Council of Soldiers and Workmen's Delegates, has informed members of the town Duma that he has given strict orders against outlawry and has threatened with death any person attempting to carry out pogroms. The government has decided not to resort to armed force for the present against the Military Committee of the Soldiers and Workmen's Delegates, but has ordered the Ministry of Justice to prosecute the members of the committee. The military will take necessary measures in case of a revolt. The Revolutionary Military Committee of the Soldiers and Workmen's Delegates demanded the right to control all orders of the general staff in the Petrograd district, which was refused. Thereupon, the committee announced that it had appointed special commissioners to undertake the direction of the military and invited the troops to observe only orders signed by the committee. Machine gun detachments moved to the soldiers' and workmen's headquarters. The government hopes for a peaceful settlement of the dispute, on which account it reached the decision not to resort to force for the present. However, the Soldiers and Workmen's Committee was decreed an illegal organization, and precautionary steps were taken to defeat any attempt at a revolt. In addressing the preliminary parliament yesterday, Premier Kerensky charged the Military Committee of the Soldiers and Workmen's Delegates with having distributed arms and ammunition to workmen. "That is why I consider part of the population of Petrograd in a state of revolt," he said, "and have ordered an immediate inquiry and such arrests as are necessary. The government will perish rather than cease to defend the honor, security, and independence of the state." The following cablegram was received yesterday by the American Alliance for Labor and Democracy from sources close to the government at Petrograd, giving an insight into the situation there. "The new attempts of the Bolsheviki to interfere with the provisional government is causing great concern to Premier Kerensky. The order out of the Petrograd Council to the garrison of the capital not to obey the order of the military governor unless approved by the council has assumed the forms of a regular revolutionary coup." In addition, Leon Trotsky, the president of the council, has issued a manifesto declaring that all functions of the government must be transferred to the Workmen's Council and to the Bolsheviki controlling it. In view of these developments, the provisional government is in continuous session. Besides that, Kerensky is having conferences with different political leaders and generals from the front. In government circles, there is a tendency for a compromise. A proposal will be made to the Petrograd Council of Workmen to give them some representation in the military administration of Petrograd. But that is not certain, and the government may take stern measures to suppress the Bolsheviki. In the meantime, the Central National Committee of all the councils of workmen and soldiers of Russia have vigorously condemned the attitude of the Petrograd Council for its illegal attempts to seize the government. The Central Committee demands immediate military action against the traitorous council, and as a first step, the arrest of the members of the Petrograd Executive Committee, Trotsky included. In commenting upon the cablegram, the alliance, which is composed of the representative labor organizations in this country, issued the following statement. "A certain amount of responsibility for the anarchistic operations of the Bolsheviki in Russia falls directly upon the shoulders of the Bolsheviki in America, whose efforts have been directed constantly toward undermining the military strength of America and her allies in the Great War for Freedom and Democracy. It is vitally important that all true Americans and all true internationalists unite in vigorous work to eliminate the Bolsheviki in America. The view of the leaders here probably cannot be changed for various reasons, but the views of misinformed followers can be changed by educational work. The situation in Russia makes urgent a vigorous and unrelenting campaign here at home for the sake of both countries and for the sake of democracy's cause along with the whole battlefront. Potsdam is poisoning the world. We must reach the reason and idealism of men and women everywhere, to the end that there may be unity throughout the civilized world in the war against autocracy, brutality, and darkness.
Loyalists and Bolsheviki in savage battles. Kerensky, at head of soldiers from the front, gives battle to Bolsheviki from Petrograd. Fierce engagement takes place near Gatchina, according to advices received by Ira Nelson Morris, American ambassador in Stockholm, but the result of the battle was not reported. Moscow's scene of battle until Bolshevik arrange a truce with the railway union after 700 casualties had occurred in battles in the streets. Stockholm, Monday. A bloody encounter has taken place near Gatchina between soldiers from the front headed by Premier Kerensky and Bolsheviki forces from Petrograd, according to advices which have reached Ira Nelson Morris, the American minister, from reliable sources. Result of the battle was not reported to Mr. Morris. Cadets attack Bolsheviki in Petrograd. Crowds in Nevsky Prospect see fighting. Petrograd, Sunday, 9 p.m. The military cadets, or junkers, encouraged by the reported proximity to the capital of the forces of Premier Kerensky, made an ineffectual attempt today to regain control of the city. This resulted in almost constant street fighting in many quarters. Early in the morning, the cadets surprised the small guard of Bolsheviki at the central telephone exchange and, backed by armored motor cars, forced the Bolsheviki to surrender. Until nearly dusk, the Grand Morskaya was the scene of battle between Bolshevik troops and cadets to the number of about 100 who were firing from windows and supported by a machine gun in the armored car in the streets in front of the building. The cadets surrendered when they had exhausted their ammunition. On the Nevsky Prospect, cadets with an armored car also tried to make a stand and precipitated another battle in which most of them were killed or made prisoner. The cadets apparently were the same as those who were defending the Winter Palace on Wednesday night and who were permitted their liberty by the Bolsheviki troops after the surrender of the palace. In spite of sporadic firing, crowds filled the Nevsky Prospect, rushing to cover when it became necessary, but otherwise going about as though nothing unusual were happening. All the streets leading into the Morskaya in the vicinity of the telephone station contain crowds of curious persons who fled at every outburst of shooting, but returned to their posts of observation when lulls occurred. It is believed that there were many victims in the fighting in Morskaya. From the windows of the Associated Press headquarters, situated a half block distant, an officer was observed to fall in the streets, apparently dead. An onlooker, hiding in a doorway, was struck by a glancing bullet and wounded in the arm. The ambulances were kept busy. New proclamations, both by the Bolsheviki and the adherents of Kerensky, appeared at intervals throughout the day. They called on the people and the troops to support this or that side and attracted crowds whenever posted. London, Monday. A Reuters dispatch from Stockholm said that travelers arriving on the frontier from Russia report that the attempt of Nikolai Lenin to form a cabinet in Petrograd failed and the foreign office officials refused to accept Leon Trotsky as foreign minister, and that in Moscow another government had been proclaimed and it is feared that there will be much bloodshed. Announcement was made yesterday of the organization and incorporation in Washington of the Russian Civilian Relief and Russian-American Cooperative Association of the United States of America, which will at once send a commission to Russia. It was authoritatively said yesterday that the purpose of the commission to Russia will be threefold. First, the commission will endeavor to relieve the sufferings of Russian civilians in the war. Second, it will work to create a better understanding between the United States and Russian democracies. And third, it will conduct a propaganda to establish a government of the United States of Russia. A member of the commission who refused to permit his name to be used at this time was authority for this statement yesterday. An organization to be known as the Bureau of the Russian Post Office Department, which is closely affiliated with the Russian Civilian Relief Association, also has been formed. Announcement yesterday said, its purpose will be to diffuse information to the United States concerning Russia and to represent the Russian Post Office Department. The scheme of the Civilian Relief Association, it was said, is to bring the United States and Russia close together in friendly ties and at the same time to promote stability in the Petrograd government. We want a United States of Russia, and we do not care who is at the head of it so long as he is an able and honest man, a member of the new commission said yesterday. We do not care whether it is Mr. Kerensky or Grand Duke Michael. We are not committed to any policy as regards a republic or a constitutional monarchy. The only thing we want is stability and freedom for Russia. We are going to work to that end.
We're going to take a brief break from the revolution to cover the role of women and women's rights in this era. We have an article on women's suffrage from the New York Herald, followed by a local article about women in public service from the Ardmore Chronicle.
Mass meeting of women sends delegation to free pickets. Members of Militant Feminine Party in New York hear Miss Paul has been subjected to tests for sanity and hurry representatives to Washington to see the president, also to urge the federal amendment. Enfranchised New York women of the National Women's Party are preparing to use their power on behalf of their sisters in jail for picketing at the White House. In the last 2 days, they have sent numerous telegrams to officials of the District of Columbia protesting the treatment of the imprisoned suffragists and bringing regular pressure to bear upon the representatives in Congress to bestir themselves in the matter. Proclaiming themselves self-supporting women voters of New York and unaffiliated with any suffrage organization, the Committee of 1,000 Women at a mass meeting in Public School No. 40 last night sent a delegation to Washington to urge President Wilson to liberate the pickets immediately and to give prompt endorsement to the federal suffrage amendment. Reports from Washington in regard to the National Women's Party have caused the awakening of the women of that organization here to a full understanding of the influence that they won in the last election. Their slogans now are, appeal to President Wilson to endorse the federal amendment, and stop the inhuman treatment of political prisoners. The reports are that Miss Alice Paul, leader of the National Woman's Party, has been subjected in the Washington jail to tests for insanity. It was reported that the imprisoned pickets receive unpalatable foods and little fresh air. The story was to the effect that Miss Paul, going to the aid of an imprisoned fellow suffragist who was suffering for want of invigorating air, broke a window after repeated requests for the opening of the window were denied. Also, Miss Paul is said to have broke another window after the matron again denied fresh air, and that she has refused to take milk and eggs because her fellow prisoners did not receive such food. Warden Zinkum assembled 5 medical authorities to pass upon Miss Paul's mental condition. Mrs. Mary Beard was chairman at the meeting of protest. Miss Lou Rogers, Mrs. J. A. H. Hopkins, Mrs. Nora C. Smitherman, and others addressed the meeting. At its close, the leaders went to the Pennsylvania station. Others went to their home to pack luggage for trips to Washington by later trains. Miss Rogers told the meeting that they must go to Washington to do their bit for the pickets, as at the present time, no one has the drop on us for equality. We have a big job on hand in Washington, she said, but we are going there as voters to demand that our disenfranchised sisters be treated as free women and not as criminals. Mrs. Hopkins told of her experiences as an imprisoned picket. Following her address, Nora C. Smitherman introduced resolutions demanding that President Wilson pledge immediately his support to the suffrage amendment as a war measure and take immediate steps for the release of imprisoned women. These were carried.
Women busy working for Red Cross. Mainline workrooms teeming with activity these days. Obedience essential. Reports from the monthly meeting of the mainline branch, No. 1 American Red Cross, held at the headquarters at Bryn Mawr on Tuesday afternoon, showed greatly increased activity in the work along the entire main line, and that plans have been made to meet the ever-increasing demands for supplies of every kind. Mrs. Charlton Yarnell, chairman of the mainline branch, presided at the meeting, which was attended by the entire executive board and representatives of the various groups and sections in the district. The report of Mrs. Elizabeth Harrison Ritter, director of the Department of Packing, Shipping, and Storage for the branch, gives a summary which shows some of the work accomplished in the month just past. The report follows. October 31st. Delivered to Shipping Department, 591 Christmas packages, also 232 packages of cigarettes donated by Mrs. Walter Baird. November 5th, shipped to USS Missouri, 300 comfort kits, 440 knitted garments. November 5th, delivered to Shipping Department, 3 boxes containing 360 hospital garments. Delivered to Surgical Dressing Department, 3 boxes containing 21,588 surgical dressings. November 5th, shipped to Camp Meade, 1 box, 110 knitted sweaters, 3 packages of chocolate. November 12th, delivered to Shipping Department, 2 boxes, 435 hospital garments, 4 boxes, 317 Christmas packages, 1 box, 1,689 miscellaneous garments. November 14th, delivered to Shipping Department, 73 Christmas packages. November 13th, delivered to Surgical Dressings Department, 4 boxes containing 12,643 surgical dressings. Summary, hospital supplies, 6 boxes, 2,484 pieces. Surgical dressings, 7 boxes, 34,231 dressings. Knitted goods, 550 pieces. Comfort kits, 330. Christmas packages, 981. Chocolate, 3 packages. Cigarettes, 232 packages. A bulletin recently issued from headquarters gives some excellent advice to workers, touching on obedience to orders, which, if followed by new workers, will avoid confusion and save time, which is necessary to conserve as the demands increase. The text of the bulletin follows. To the workers of hospital supplies, headquarters is about to issue a bulletin to all of our workers to the effect that the women of America must learn to cooperate with the Red Cross and the government by unquestioning and uncomplaining obedience to orders. It is necessary that the orders for the hospital garments be changed to meet changing conditions. Even though contradictory orders should come in within a few days of each other, they must be accepted and followed without complaints. The success of the English women and their enormous accomplishments have been made possible simply by their soldier-like obedience. Should we be less patriotic than our sisters? We are working earnestly to help our own. It is just as easy to do good work as poor. Will you do your bit by following patiently the instructions given so that our output may be not only large but perfect in every way? An interesting figure in the workrooms every afternoon is Mrs. Lamond of Sibley Avenue, Ardmore, who, in her 86th year, is able to turn out dozens of pieces of work, all done accordingly to the standard and finished with exceeding neatness. The bulletin board at headquarters bears the invitation. Workers want it in every department, and an earnest plea is made for women of Ardmore to respond.
Next on Mail Call, we turn to a different area of the world, Jerusalem. An article on a victory for the British Expeditionary Forces, published in the Washington Times on December 10th, 1917.
Jerusalem, long under Turkish control, captured by British Expeditionary Forces. Holy City falls before assaults of General Allenby. London, December 10th. Jerusalem has fallen. Capture of the Holy City, Christianity's most hallowed spot, by General Allenby's British Expeditionary Forces was announced here today. Capture of Jerusalem brings the city under Christian control again for the first time in 401 years. During all that time, it has been under sway of the Turks. Since the founding of the ancient city, about 1400 BC, it has been fought over, captured, razed, rebuilt under fire, and now the spoils of a dozen armies in wars and struggles dating from 1000 BC down to the Crusaders of the 11th century. British armies began their sweep up the valley of Palestine from the Suez Canal early last spring, almost unnoted and overshadowed by the terrific conflict on the West Front. First General Murray and later General Allenby pushed steadily upward against the Turks. Jerusalem's fate was sealed when this British expeditionary force on November 1st captured Gaza immediately after taking the ancient city of Beersheba. General Allenby sent his forces rapidly north, and a fortnight later they took Jaffa, the olden city of Joppa, and seaport to Jerusalem. From Joppa, the British began their encircling movement around the holy city itself, striking north and east. Reports last week said they were within about 9 miles of the city. Bethlehem, where the Savior was born, lies a scant 6 miles due south of Jerusalem and is presumably also now in British hands. Jerusalem's fall will be a tremendous blow at Turkish morale, according to the belief here today. Loss of the shrine of Christendom, possession of which has been the boast of Muslim for centuries, will have a far-reaching effect throughout Turkey. Recent dispatches have indicated Enver Pasha, Turkey's ambitious war minister and the man who conceived the Turco-German alliance, was tottering from his place of power while British armies were sweeping all before them in Mesopotamia and Palestine.
We now turn locally to the pages of our very own publication, The Villanovan, a passage on The Knights of Columbus as it was published in December 1917.
Knights of Columbus War Activities. In the present World War, welfare activities are common in the many fraternal organizations throughout our country. There is one organization that stands out preeminent in this respect, and it deserves special mention in these columns. We refer to the works of the Knights of Columbus War Committee in the Army and Navy training camps. The Knights purpose primarily to look after the interests of our Catholic soldiers and sailors. So enthusiastically have their noble efforts been supported by the Catholics of the country that the scope of their activities has been extended to an amazing degree, and we rejoice to see centers for recreation open to all regardless of creed. How thoroughly this is appreciated by the enlisted men is clearly seen from the large number in attendance at the buildings erected for this purpose. In leaving their homes to enter the ranks, our young men are removed from the Catholic atmosphere that pervaded their home lives. They are withdrawn from Catholic surroundings and influences, which are so important to their spiritual welfare. It is the avowed intention of the Knights to establish and maintain the atmosphere in the soldiers' and sailors' lives, and it is the spirit that is actuating them in the noble work in which we now see them engaged. Geniality, fraternity, and above all, love of God are their watchwords. Chief among the means that the Knights are employing is the movement to provide a larger number of chaplains for our boys in the service. The number allowed by the War Department was meager enough. So meager that, had it not been for this movement, a large percentage of the Catholic soldiers would have been unable to hear Mass on Sundays and would have been denied that privilege so important to men engaged in their task, the frequent reception of sacraments. The inconvenience due to a shortage of chaplains has been in a great measure alleviated, but there is still much to be done. It is said to the credit of the Knights that, in the face of all obstacles, they have not altered their determination to extend this great work. We at Villanova have been in frequent communication with our own boys in the service. They speak in glowing terms of the splendid achievements of the Knights of Columbus and the patriotic fervor created in the ranks by the unselfish efforts. The Catholics of America should indeed be grateful and proud that we have an organization composed of men of our own faith who are proving by their works that this oft-repeated charges of disloyalty and lack of patriotism among Catholics are base falsehoods. We must be deeply grateful that our young men, even though they may often be in surroundings filled with temptations to their spiritual and moral life, will always have the consolations and protections of their religion. We should be grateful to this organization, the KFC, which provides that someday our boys will either come back to us better men and better Catholics by reason of their service to the country, or that they will die heroic deaths surrounded by the consolation of religion and signed with the cross of Mother Church.
Our final segment on this episode of Mail Call comes to us from the Evening Star in Washington, D.C. A final grim word on Russia, published December 19th, 1917.
No hope that Russia will return to allies. U.S. must understand situation to avoid depression and disappointments. By Frank H. Simons. If we are to avoid future disappointment, depression which will weaken our wills and break down our courage, it is essential to recognize that for the duration of the present war, Russia has ceased to be a factor. There is no basis in reason or just expectation for the long-cherished belief that after delays, disorders, domestic strife, Russia would return to the Allies. Russia will not return, and, despite all reasoning to the contrary, Russia was lost not at the moment when the revolution gained control, but at the hour when Stürmer and his reactionary associates sold their country out to Germany in the hope of preventing the revolution. It is an easy assertion, frequently made, that had the Allies dealt more frankly with revolutionary Russia, the new masters of Russian policy would have renewed the alliance of the old regime, and the war would have gone on to its inevitable conclusion, the defeat of Germany and the liberation of Europe. But this assertion is based upon one enormous assumption, namely, that the Russian people were willing to fight for anything outside of Russia and except for peace. The truth which is becoming clearer every day is that the revolution succeeded, that the present leaders gained control, because the single imperious demand of the Russian people was for peace. Peace at almost any price. Kerensky rose and fell as he was accepted and then distrusted as the agent of peace. Lenin and Trotsky are succeeding because they are better advised as to Russian will and are prepared to crush every obstacle to attain peace. The essential mistake all of us have made in thinking of Russia has been in attempting to interpret Russian emotion in terms of our own feelings. We, the people of Britain, France, and the United States, entered this war on our own volition. We consented to the formal declaration of war unhesitatingly, and we accepted our government's actions as our own, as in fact it was. But the Russian people went to war willy-nilly as a result of the decision of rulers whom they hated and in obedience to a system which they loathed. We in Britain, France, and the United States perceive clearly that until Belgium and Serbia are evacuated, there can be no basis for peace negotiation, for peace is not a mockery, because such a peace would give permanence to the German conception that force is the only element of value in human and international relations, and that the nation armed can write its own laws with the sword and the submarine. But Russia shares none of our Western conceptions. He woke from slavery to find himself in a war which had brought to him intense agony, and this war was made by his old masters, whose yoke had been heavy and brutal. His two emotions were comprehended in the determination to have done with the old masters, and to end the war they had plunged him into without his consent and without regard to his rights or even to his life. Russia, for reasons comprehensible and by no means culpable, has determined to make peace with Germany. This determination is the determination of the vast majority of the Russian people. We may hold them blind and misguided, but we must not mistake the fact that under our theory of democracy, they are entitled to shape their own policy. It is idle and it is folly to rail at Russia. It is even inconsistent with our own faith as proclaimed again and again in our assertion that we are fighting for democracy. In sum, it is essential to recognize that Russia has left our alliance, that there was never any chance of retaining her after the revolution, and there is not the smallest prospect of regaining her now. This war was not declared with the consent of the Russian people. They were never engaged in honor to fight it. They have not deserted a cause to which their loyalty was engaged. They have blindly, unwisely, madly, the adjective does not matter, but unmistakably rejected a share in it. They are gone, and we who are left must face the fact, fight on as we can, and make the greater effort that we will not be demanded to attain the end which we all desire to attain, the protection of liberty, the assertion of law, the defense of humanity. Russia has left us, the United States is taking the Russian place, and in another year we'll be able to fill it. Meantime, it is for all of us to face facts and dismiss illusions. The war will be won by the present alliance against Germany, if it has the courage and the determination to stand firmly now in the presence of the last desperate offensive of an enemy whose defeat is assured, whose victory would be the downfall of all we love and hold to be worth living for in this world.
That's all for Mail Call, a podcast of news, letters, and stories from the Great War. This episode featured the voice talents of Anne Minicozzi, Damian Katz, Adele Lindenmeyer, Amanda McCollum, Father Joseph Loya, Christine Bucher, Kim Scheimer, Nicole Subic, Chris Washburn, and Laura Bang. I'm your narrator, Chris Hallberg. Our executive producers are Laura Bang and Amanda McCollum. This episode was produced and edited by Amanda McCollum, whose time at our library has sadly come to an end. Thank you for your hard work bringing this podcast to life. You will be missed. Historical documents for this episode were accessed through the digital collections of the Digital Library of Villanova University and the Library of Congress. Our theme music is Till We Meet Again, as performed by Nicholas Orlando's Orchestra. The Mail Call podcast is a project of Home Before the Leaves Fall, a Great War Centennial Exposition. For more information, please visit our website at wwionline.org. Away.